Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where my guest today is Jacqueline Winspear. Now, you may know her as the author of the Maisie Dobbs series. You know that small series that has 15 books in it that are loved by so many readers? Well, today, we're going to be talking about her memoir. This Time Next Year, We'll Be Laughing. And we all sort of hope we will be laughing. So it's a Book Reporter Bets On selection. I read it this weekend. I absolutely love it. And in this interview, I hope you're going to figure out why. So welcome, Jackie. So nice to have you here.
And it's lovely to join you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I love this book. You really brought your family alive for me. I feel like I know your family. I feel like I should be having a holiday with them. What made you decide to write this memoir now? Like, why at this moment?
Well, actually, I first started writing a memoir many years ago. Before I ever touched fiction, I was writing a memoir. But it just, you know, sometimes as a writer, you're trying to bend words to your will. It's kind of like being a sculptor. You know, you're working the clay, and the clay never went into the shape that I wanted to go into. And why now? It just felt like the right time. And I know this sounds kind of odd. I think also my parents passing, you know, they're now both gone. They're both, you know, dad passed away in 2012, mum in 2015. And I think in a way it gave me permission to write the story. But having said that, I think they would have loved the fact that I was writing the story, and especially their story. Because I wanted to write it. And I, you know, I love playing with time and place. And when I was talking to my husband, who's an American, you know, born and raised in Cleveland, very different upbringing to me. And, you know, he was often saying, wow, that's really different, isn't it? You know, and his experience was, you know, the polar opposite to mine in many ways. So it just felt the right time.
And, you know, we've met places along the way. We've met at BoucherCons. We've met at different conferences. But I didn't know this backstory. And it's just, I think I understand your other work more for reading it. But I also just feel like it's such a from the heart of what it was really like to be living in the small town that you were living in. I don't know. I love your description of the essence of memoir. We don't just look back at an event in our past. We're remembering the memory of what happened. It's a bit like, I love this, putting the laundry through two wash cycles. So how emotional was all that remembering? What was it like to be doing that?
I think I didn't realize how emotional it was until I'd finished, because I wanted to tell the stories. And then once I'd finished, I found that there were things that, you know, I think you have, as a writer, I can't speak for everyone, I speak for me. I write from the heart anyway. I feel that my stories are in my heart. So I put my heart into it. Mm-hmm. I don't think I expected that emotional, fallout's a very strong word, but it's the only one I can grasp at the moment. The aftermath of writing a memoir, and there is an aftermath, because as you remember, more memories come back, and then you have to pick and choose. Otherwise, you know, it would be the sort of, you know, 17 volumes of Jackie Winspear growing up, you know.
Right.
And it's the ones that really resonate, and the ones that reflect most what you're trying to talk about, which for me was family, time, and place. The interesting thing actually was my brother's reaction. Because when I was writing, I said to him after I had the manuscript, look, do you want to read this? I just want to make sure, because, you know, he's got a fairly major role. And he said, no, I'll read it when it's done. And then, of course, you know, a publisher sends out early copies for review, and he found some reviews on the internet, and he said, so why haven't I got your book? And I said, well, you didn't want it until it's published. He said, well, I want it now. And it was a few weeks ago, I said to him, because he had had it for a while, I said, have you read it yet? He said, oh yeah, I've read it three times. I went, what? Oh, and he read it three times, one after the other. And only way it made one little correction for me, which I got to hand it to him. And it's really interesting the impact it has on family. Mm-hmm. You know, and not all my, only a couple of members of my family have read it so far, but my brother, you know, you ask about my emotional reaction, his was, it has been interesting as well. Yeah, I think it's actually like, brought us, we were close anyway, but it's brought us closer in a different way.
I was thinking that because you could now go back and talk about these things that clearly impacted you that he thinks about, but now it's like, wait, remember that moment when we were doing X or Y or Z. And I like it because the three generations of your family are fleshed out. It's not just, you know, you and your parents, it's the generation before as well. Were there lots of notes before the writing actually began? Did you have tons of notes?
Not really, no. I mean, I've written on and off about my family. Mm-hmm. I used to contribute to a blog, which is now defunct, called nakedauthors.com. So I often wrote about my family because I like the personal essay that you can, something that's happening in the world, you can weave in experience, you can reflect upon it. It could be an anniversary. It could be a similar experience of something. So I have written about my family before, but for this, I just kind of jumped in, mm-hmm. you know, and jumped in at the place that felt right. And it was that conversation that my parents had when my dad was in his final weeks, mm-hmm. You know, which I don't want to give too much away, but when he turned to her and just said, haven't we had a great life? Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, went to hear one parent say that to the other, and you know that to outsiders, a lot of that life didn't look so great.
Right. And they're just saying they're celebrating in that moment. Mm-hmm. And he wants to make sure he's leaving her with that thought, if it was great. So that if you are going to question later on when I'm gone, I just want you to know, I thought it was a great life. I thought it was a very, very poignant moment to be kicking things off. And I love the way you refer to it. And there are lots of quotes I pulled from this book as stop, rewind, now go back a bit more, stop, there it is, now play. Because when you're sitting and having that memory, it's, what did I really hear? Oh, wait, go back a little bit further, because the story needs to be told by going back a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And then, wait a second, is that really the way I thought about it? And I just thought it was such a good way of expressing in the terms that we're so used to today, of rewind that video. Let me see what they really said. Let me see what really happened. Did you reach out to the family to enhance any of the personal memories?
No, that's something I didn't do because then it changes my memory of a story mm-hmm. I've heard. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I have, you know, since heard other stories, but I'm like a little story collector anyway. I think actually all writers do this. You know, you hear snippets of conversation, you hear family discussions, especially when people lower their voices and you're a kid. It's not, I don't know what they're talking about, but I think I need to know this. But you collect those stories and those impressions. So no, I didn't, because, you know, it's like a prism. We're all coming from a different point to look right. at an event. And how I remember it might not be how someone else remembers it. I mean, I think one of the revelations for my brother was everything that happened when he had his appendicitis. Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. he was somewhat out of it. There are things that he remembered, but then, you know, when I said to him, well, the surgeon was an American, it was he, you know, it was so no, but that point you make about the stop, rewind, and so on, I think in a way memoir has, there's a lot in common with cinematography, because we zoom the camera in to describe a scene. We, you know, pan to look at a larger sort of panorama to see what is happening, that little speck there, you know. And so there's that sort of sense of almost documentary, I think, mm-hmm. when you're writing now. That's just my personal perspective. But
I would say that when I was reading, I was feeling it was very cinematic in tone. I felt like I was watching the movie of your life, and I was reading the movie of your life. I really do, because your descriptions are so good, but it's also the way you juxtapositioned what had happened to everybody and what had gone on. I felt like it was very well played out. And sometimes when you read things, they're dull spots, and there weren't any. And I will tell you that sometimes if you're reading a memoir, somebody's going to get obsessed with something. But you had these quick takes of, we'll talk about some of them as we go through. But I felt that it was all still flowing. And it was obvious that you were a very strong storyteller. Sometimes people, when they get caught up in their memories, they're not telling a story at the same time. It's like cut and dried like this. Mm-hmm. But this was like weaving me through of what was going on, which I think comes a lot from also your beautiful fiction writing of being able to tell an arc of a story. How to do the arc of the memoir, I felt like you were doing at the same time.
I think when, you know, I've always been interested in how we express time and place. And time, I've realized, really fascinates me, mm-hmm. which is why I think I loop back and forth a bit, that something that happened then, how the thread goes through to now, you know, and I describe, for example, my grandfather's shell shock. One of the aspects of that was a very deep sensitivity to sound. So my dad grew up in a very quiet house. So he didn't really like loud noises. Mind you, as I say, he made an exception for a good swing band when he and my mum were dancing. Mm-hmm. But I find that, you know, I love music, but I don't like everything booming at me. I don't like sudden loud noises. I'm very sensitive to that. Mm-hmm. So but that's just an example. How does the past come like in waves to the present and then loop back again?
Yeah, and with that, let's talk about your mom's memories of down evacuation, which you describe as an experience, albeit an unwanted one. And you know, I always thought that children would go, these families would want them, they would go, the children would be well cared for, well taken care of, everything would be lovely, it'd be sort of like their vacation of going on a vacation or a holiday. And reading this, I realized there was a lot, there could be abuse, there could be people that didn't want them, they were just there for the money, you know, just for what was going on. So let's share a little bit about what happened with your mother with down evacuation, like when she had to go.
Yeah, it was the reason she was used to refer to it as when we went down evacuation. But that's because, you know, going from London to Kent, for example, you go, if you're looking at a map, you go down. Right. And, you know, you were going to be evacuated. And she was evacuated with her younger siblings. There were 10 in the family. The older three ended up in the services, which left 7. And she was evacuated with another 5 of her siblings. The youngest one was not evacuated at that time because she was too young. Actually, that was my youngest aunt, and she's only recently passed away, actually. Aww. But she had lots of, you know, and she's always liked to tell me her stories. But anyway, it was very difficult because I think even though the evacuation of children in a time of war was, should there be another war, was planned right from the end of the First World War, it was somewhat chaotic. Mm-hmm. And you know, it wasn't a case of people said, oh, yes, we would love you to come and stay with us. You know, people were paid. You mm-hmm. didn't do it for nothing, for a start. And yes, there was a certain amount of volunteering in an area, but some people didn't really want to take in kids from London because they thought, oh, you know, they're London kids. So, but the funny thing is that the experiences of children were so vastly different because there were some children that came from homes in London that, you know, had indoor bathrooms and things like that, and then suddenly they're living in some little ramshackle cottage in the country somewhere, and they have to walk right down to the bottom of the garden to use the privy, you know, which for London kids is terrifying, you know.
It's just like, yeah, not good.
Yeah, and but in fact for my mother and her siblings it was very challenging for the girls in particular because the in the family to which they were evacuated, the man was a as they said, used to say in those times, interfered with little girls. Mm-hmm. And my mom spent half her time, I think, stopping that happening. being incredibly vigilant, which showed up in her later life. She was a hyper-vigilant person, you know. You know, when I was a child, it was don't speak to strangers, don't do this. I actually wasn't quite sure what a stranger was. But, you know, there was that fear as well that something terrible could happen to you.
And then when you're 14, you're like, now you can go back. Now all of a sudden it's safe for you. I did like that as well.
Yeah, that was also, you know, I mean, her mother wanted them back as soon as they were 14 to go out to work, which broke my mother's heart, because you were evacuated with your school in general. And that gave a sense of continuity. But, you know, if you think of my mother, it was and my aunt has told me a certain extent about her recollections of this, that, you know, I think it took them 3 days to get to wherever they were going. And it wasn't that far. It's just that they went to one sort of it was a sort of stately home where they opened up one of the big rooms and the kids had to sleep on the floor. And then they went somewhere else. And eventually they went to this particular town where they were put into the cattle pens, where normally they would have the market, the cattle market. And the people would come along and say, oh, well, you know, I'll take those two. I'll have that one. You know, oh, I'll take those two boys. Farmers liked boys because they could put them to work.
And they could
One of my uncles ran away at the age of eight. He was 8 years old when he ran away because he missed his mum so much. Tried to get back to London and didn't make it before he was caught.
Well, you know. You think about even like the pandemic today, everybody's locked in together. But if they sat there and said, oh, your children are going to have to go X or Y or Z, children wouldn't be able to cope. The coping skills weren't there like at all. But I feel like the way you were describing they were just very much, well, this is what we have to do. This is what we must do.
Yes.
This is what we must do. And we will abide by what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Except I think it helped. I don't know that any of it helped, really. But, you know, you went with your school. There was a familiarity with your teachers and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom said she can, told me that she could remember walking to the station. Or, you know, children in what they used to call a crocodile, holding hands, and the mums following, and then they could only go so far, and their children were loaded onto trains they didn't know where they were going. They had a little label, you know, tied to their coat, and they had a bag with their belongings on, and my mum was instructed, just keep everybody together. Her mum said, keep everybody together. But she couldn't. She couldn't keep the boys with her. One of my uncles was ended up being evacuated. The family made me laugh about this. I'd heard this story years ago that he was taken in by a very well-to-do couple. He was quite young, so how old was he? Would have been about six or something like that, maybe younger, five or six, and very well-to-do couple who actually wanted to adopt him. And my grandmother, of course, said absolutely not. But they made him into sort of like a little Lord Fauntleroy. and he came home with a very, let's say, a very posh accent, and immediately had sort of nine other kids laying into him saying, who do you think you are? But
are you so special? You know, you're not special. Yeah.
And he came home thinking he was very special, you know. He was actually one of my favorite uncles. But
Very impressionable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I learned so much about life in England post-war. I mean, I thought I knew a lot, but this book fleshed out so much of what was happening outside the city, because you knew a lot about what was going on there. And then I loved your dad's line is, never to be wed to the past, love. Never be wed to the past. How has the past affected your present is what I'm really sitting there thinking. And I think he spent a lot of time just sitting there like, don't get stuck back here. Just move on. Go on with your life. Do you think that he did a very good job, or they both did a very good job of being able to do that? Just move on from where it was?
I think so. I mean, they were both deeply affected, I think, by, you know, their growing up. But my dad was definitely one to say, just move on from it. You know, I can remember when I bought my first house, and he said something similar to me, that he came up because he was really, you know, he's one of those really handy people. He worked in the construction business, so, and I needed work to be done. And he was putting in a new sill. I don't see them so much on American houses, perhaps on the East Coast more so. And it's, you know, it's as you go into the house, there's the sill near the step and it has weather stripping in it. And anyway, I was just coming home one day and a piece of brick dropped out and I went, oh, and I picked it up. I said, I'm going to keep that brick from my home. Brick from my first house. And he just said, no, he said, do not be. And he said the same, almost the same thing. Do not be wed to bricks and mortar. Never be wed to bricks and mortar, because it will mean you'll never move on. You'll never go to where you're meant to be next.
Isn't that interesting? So it's like, okay, you can want to have an adventure, never be so locked down and enjoy a place so much that it won't let you have another place to go. Yeah. It's another thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Mind you, he was a fine one to talk, I will say. You know?
Yeah. Wait a second. I think he lived in the same place for a very long time.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, it was like, wait a second. We're off the beaten track living here. The rest of the family's in London. Are you sure, Dad, about that? Or maybe he was telling you, don't be like me. You know, do something different from what I did.
I think I would say that my parents wanted us to be adventurous. Mm-hmm. They wanted us to enjoy our lives and see as much of the world as we could, because of course their generation, they couldn't see as much of the world, but as soon as they were able, they loved to travel. They loved coming over to America, really loved it. So yeah, that was nice.
You described that of like, you know, they coming to the States, and a lot of people would say, oh, my children moving that far away. They're like, we'll book our ticket. We'll come see you so that we could see your world and be part of it. And I thought that was so lovely.
Yeah.
What was it like writing such a personal story compared to mystery writing? Was it a different vibe that you had to do, or is writing writing to you?
Well, writing's writing. Here's the thing about mystery, I suppose. I always see it as the archetypal journey through chaos to resolution. And so I often don't think, oh, I'm writing a mystery. I think I'm telling a story. It has a certain framework, but I'm telling a story about what happens to this set of people with this set of circumstances at this time. And there's, as I say, an arc to the story. I think in a way, writing memoir, especially as I've constructed it, which is a series of stories, if you will, there is that going through chaos and then there is a resolution found, you know, so there was that chaotic time, for example, when I had an accident at 15 months, and that plays out in different ways. You know, it comes up in a different way as time goes on, but there is a definite arc to that part of my story. There's an arc to the story of you know, my mum, for example, being evacuated in the war, to my father's army experiences, and indeed to my grandfather and grandmother, and how it's kind of interesting how all those arcs come in to make
it is
a saga, I suppose.
And you know what? There's also this pervading of what had happened with your mother. She never got more educated than 14. And that's always playing in the back of her mind as she's trying to get a job, as she's going for places. And when you think about what she achieved, like where she had gone on with limited education, but it was really, I saw in her such perseverance. So this can do kind of attitude, and I will make this work. And why should I just be stuck? Like when she goes in and asks the dentist for a raise and she doesn't get it, her idea is not to sit back down and take it. It's what am I going to do next? Where am I going to go? What do I deserve?
I will say that all my uncles and aunts and my cousins, I think we're all a bit like that. You know, it's just like, okay, that door's closed. I'm going to find the next one that opens. Because although my mother's formal education ended when she was 14, her education didn't end then. Mm-hmm. And that's the same if I look to my uncles and aunts. They all did pretty darn well. Mm-hmm. And all of them left school at 14. She wasn't the only one that won a scholarship and couldn't take it up to a good school. You know, if I think of my aunt in Canada, you know, she worked for the government for years. She did really well. She was flying all over the place. You know, various, my uncles and aunts, they did interesting things. And certainly that's true of my cousins, you know, and on both sides of the family, you know. So there's just because you have not had formal education or your formal education ended early, it doesn't mean to say that you're not educated, because, oh boy, are the family voracious readers. You know, my grandmother was a real reader. I don't know how she ever managed to have 10 kids, actually.
How she managed to do that when she's sitting doing the reading. Well, you know, it was interesting. My uncle passed away, oh my gosh, it's years ago now. But I never realized until his funeral what had happened to him during World War II. I never realized he left high school after his sophomore year. And he went over and he was in Italy and he was actually helping my family heritage is from Italy. He was helping a lot of family members there who were hiding in caves, like all these very interesting points that he didn't learn until his funeral about all these pieces. And he came back and he got into college and he was going at nights and he went on to have this big job with the American Cancer Society. Like when she reaches for a cigarette, give her a kiss instead was one of his lines that he came up with, which is hugely pivotal. But you realize that there was this whole gap in his education along the way, but what he had done in the war impacted so much. And you know, these days, everybody is so into getting their kids into college and getting them into this, that, the other thing. And I'm like, real world experience, look what it meant for the whole, what it was, the greatest generation. Like, what did it really mean for these people? It was being boots on the ground of figuring it out. It wasn't just sitting in a classroom someplace. It's world knowledge.
Absolutely true. And there's a phenomenon that happened on both sides of the Atlantic. And that was it started, I think, in the sort of mid 1800s with the Industrial Revolution and so on. And that was the whole idea of quote unquote night school that, you know, you went to college and in definitely, you know, in the UK, and I know for a fact here too, that there were whole institutes built and set up purely for people so that they could continue their education at night or whatever on their own. And you know, no one had distance learning then. Just came home, you had a bite to eat if you were lucky, or you went straight back to school again and you didn't go. You know, my mom definitely and her siblings all took advantage of that. As did I, you know, at a certain point in my life.
Yeah, and you know, right after the pandemic hit, Harvard was doing some free classes online and people were just jumping on to do them because it was an opportunity. And I think that it's the book is very much about seizing opportunity as time goes on. It's not obstacle, it's opportunity. And what do you do when opportunity presents yourself? And I think that so many times people get so lazy. There's a natural progression to things, and this was not going to be a natural progression. It was going to go like back and forth, different places. You know, your mystery writer friends encourage you to take notes. I know Hallie Ephraim was telling you to take notes as things were going on during your parents' health crisis. And I thought about this a couple of years ago, probably a few years ago at this point. Historical fiction author Allison Pataki was facing a health crisis with her husband. And Lee Woodruff, whose husband was Bob Woodruff, had been injured in a terrible accident, said, take notes because something to the effect that you want to write notes at the moment because you won't remember it the same way later. Like, just make sure you have everything down. And do you feel that to be true? Like, you know, you're going off of memory, but at the same time, when your parents were dying, there was like, take notes on how you're feeling right now, because you're going to interpret it differently later.
I didn't take as many notes as I think I could have, because I was really exhausted, actually. I had quite a lot on my plate, to be perfectly honest with you. But there were some things I definitely wrote down. But I don't know. I like to take notes anyway. I tell you, I note down little things. I don't make copious notes. I'll write down just a few words. You know, if someone says something, for example, and I the words sort of stay with me, and they might turn up anywhere once I've taken. But it was actually when I shared with Holly the story of my brother finding something while we were clearing my mum's, when she was actually in the hospital before she went to move from the house, and something I found actually, and his work from school, and pointed out to him that it was actually really, really good, even though the teacher had not given him a good mark. And it was a lovely moment actually, because I told him, that stinky teacher didn't get it right. This is really good writing. And he just said to me, I'll just throw it away. It's nothing, you know. And then I just put it to one side and then saw him tuck it away in his case, which was really a lovely moment, you know.
But those little special things. Little special moments.
I think there are little special moments. And just as an aside, to give an example of that, a few years ago, I was in the process of buying a horse. And, you know, a vet comes out to do the vet check. And I was standing next to him as we watched the horse being trotted away from us. You know, they do this thing called a flexion test. And he looked at me and he went, "Got snappy little hocks, ain't she?" And I thought, I have got to write that down. And I literally, as soon as his back went, "Got snappy little hocks," you can bet that is going to appear in one of my books. Exactly. You know, and so there's things that people say that you just have to keep, and you know, things that you know, my you know, definitely not that I mentioned this in the memoir, but you know, in my father's last day, my mother was very concerned that he wasn't getting enough sustenance, and mm-hmm. I knew it was too late. You know, there was mm-hmm. no reason to give him sustenance. We were on the home stretch, you know, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Yeah. So she's sitting there saying, "But if he eats, that would yeah. be a good thing. He yeah. should be eating. He should be doing this."
And she insisted on bringing a fresh tube of toothpaste in for him, the day before he died, which mm-hmm. was, you know, it's what it is. It's that desire just to try and keep everything normal.
Normal. I was just going to say, you're looking for normalcy.
Yeah, we look for normal. And haven't we been all doing that in the last, mm-hmm. you know, 10 months? Let's mm-hmm. look for normal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's and people talk about the new normal. But, you know, there is not a new normal, because normal is not going to happen for a long time. And in truth, normal doesn't exist. It's just, it's a myth.
It's just life. It's just life. Yeah. Life has shifted. It's not like this is normal. This is the, mm-hmm. this is like what your life is now. This is what's going yeah. on. It's funny you say that about finding things. I've been going through the attic. We've lived in this house for 31 years. I've accumulated a lot of stuff. I clearly yeah. never threw out anything my kids did in school. And I'm making them each a box. And I said, "And you're not getting it now because you throw the whole thing out. And someday, like that piece that your brother has, it is going to matter. But it's not going to matter now." So yeah. I'm going through and I'm figuring out the things. I also realized that I am a real pack rat. I found the birth announcement for a friend's child who's now 31. So I was like, and I've been snapping pictures of these things as I find them and saying to my friends, and go, "Look what I found. I didn't throw it out yet." You know, so.
Yeah. My father kept every single birthday card he had ever received from my brother and I, right from the ones where, you know, it's scribble across the page, every single birthday card. And, you know, when you live an awful long way away, you have to be pretty ruthless with stuff. Mm-hmm. All their certificates from their ballroom dancing and things like that is just like, "Oh my gosh, what am I going to do with these?" So I kept a few, you know. Mm-hmm. It's then what, you know, and you cherish things for a while and then you think, you know,
yeah. So,
not to be wed to the past.
Not to be wed to the past. And I know that if I'm going through this now, going through all these boxes, and I know I've just whittled it down. I know I'll do another, like, okay, over. But it's the interesting, the memories that are coming up with it. You know, I really love that there was a rhythm to life when you were living on the farm. I really love that that was going on. And there were different seasons. This is what happens. It's planting, it's cultivating, it's harvesting, whatever. Did you love that time in your life? Because it sure felt like it was this amazingly wonderful time.
I think, you know, being born and raised in a very rural area, working on farms and so on, you do have that sense of a rhythm. To everything, there is a season. Mm-hmm. And I think it's incredibly grounding. And that's, I think, isn't that a great word? It's grounding, and there you are in the ground. Yeah. You know, you, mm-hmm. you have your hands in the earth. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that's missing very much for so many people today. And look how people have been rushing from the cities during the COVID thing, because they suddenly realize, you know what, I'm stuck here and I have to get out of here. Because, you know, I mean, even 200 years ago, people had their feet on the earth mm-hmm. every single day. And agriculture, we were so much more sort of attached, sort of connected with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that is with me still. You know, that's why I go out for hikes, and you know, I spend a lot of time in nature. I mean, it's I have to have trees around me, you know, and mm-hmm. fields, and be able to see wildlife, and I actually love I love farms, actually. I don't live on a farm. I live near ranches. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing because I love the seasons as they come to me through being near an agricultural area. You know, the fact that, you know, in April, I can smell the orange blossom. You know, I can wake up and smell that orange blossom. I have a friend who lives right in the Napa Valley, and she loves, which of course has been very badly struck by wildfire, but she was pretty much raised there. And she said she loves crush, that time of the year when you can smell mm-hmm. the crush. You know, it's not just smelling, you're not just smelling grapes, you smell the crush. And for me, there were certain times of year when just the sense of the aroma in the air, just with this is a season. And hop picking was very big because it was a very significant industry in Kent, where I'm from. That's changed now. But, you know, it was also the time in school, the school year, when you go up a year. So there was always that sense that there's this aroma in the air and you're moving on and up. Yes, I love it that life has a rhythm, and I think we feel that rhythm more keenly when we are close to the natural world, obviously. Mm-hmm. Obviously.
And it, these last couple of months, so many people started growing. They would start growing vegetables. I went to the garden center. Look, I've gardened for years. And I went in and I was like, where are all the plants? And they were like, oh, no, you don't understand. Everybody's already been here. I was like, wow, I'm usually on my usual timing. In fact, two nights ago, we had a very hard freeze here. And we had everything covered outside. But we went out this morning and all the basil's gone, like even under the tarp. And I'm like kicking myself of like, why did I just not go out last week and cut it all back? Like, what was I thinking? Yeah. And all of a sudden everything was green and everything went brown and black. Really in 2 days, it's like everything has completely changed. And I'm like, why was I not on top of this? What was I doing? Oh, I was reading books or doing life. You know?
I had a really funny experience at the end of last week. It was the end of last week. I had to go to the post office and I had a package that was all ready to go. All I had to do was pop it on the side. So, so I went in and there's everybody socially distanced, about four or five people. And there was this one man at the counter and he was obviously collecting something. And the postmistress came out and she's got three crates, narrow crates, you know, about 6 inches tall, and she's holding them like this. And the chirruping that was coming from inside the crates, everybody just looked. And we all watched this man collect his crates and go out. And I said, what's in those crates? You know, and everybody listened as I said, what's in those crates? And she said, oh, they're baby chickens. I said, who knew the post office shipped chicks? And of course, everybody just started laughing about the idea of the post office shipping chicks. You know? But I found it fascinating that you know, it would have not been more surprising had they came out with a bull or something and said, oh, this is for you. I thought it was wonderful.
In the back room, what that must have been like, would they come pick up the chicks already?
Yeah, I know. It was this, and you could just imagine, oh, we're here.
This is what we're going to do.
I loved it. I loved it because I would love to have chickens, but...
Nothing a pig, and then they smell, and then it's a mess. And it's
But you know, I know how to look after chickens. I'm a country girl.
where we live, it's very country like here, and there are places you can go get somebody to say, I have fresh eggs today. I'll be very happy to go pick them up. I'm very happy to go see their setup. Yeah. It's lovely. I love that your mom would take you once a week to town for errands, and that the library was a stop on that trip. But I love the way the journey of going into town, because this was not close. I mean, these people did not need Fitbit. These people did not need to measure their steps. There were so many steps. And here you're either walking or on your trike or whatever. She's pushing the stroller, and then she's going to put all the food in there. Your brother's going to end up a little squished in the front. And then you go to the library and get the books and carry those home. And we think that we're so pampered these days. I know kids that wouldn't like, oh, I don't even want to carry from the library to my car, let alone what life was like. But the library was such a special moment because she didn't just get for her. She got for the whole neighborhood. I love that.
Yes, she did. And, you know, it wasn't a stroller, as we know, a stroller. It was a big baby carriage, the sort they had then, with one, you know, you have the two big wheels and then the two smaller wheels. And, you know, as I said in the book, you know, I especially when she had the summer canopy on, you know, which was made of this white cotton broderie anglaise, you know, it made my brother look as though he was in a ship in full sail, you know. Yeah, she would be, because there were elderly people on our street, and she would take their library books back. She would choose books for them because she knew everybody's tastes, you know, who liked the romances, you know, the fact that Mr. Kilby liked the Westerns, as did my dad. And I knew all the little phases she went through. And literally, as the shopping went into the pram and then the books went into the pram, you know, my brother was scrunched up. And I'm sure, you know, no wonder he wailed. You know, yeah. It was like, you know, a book, another book, you're slinging another book at me. But yeah, and I was allowed to choose my two books. And I really, it was a very small, very, very tiny library. And a few years later, it moved into bigger premises. You know, I think when I was about 16, 17, they built a brand new youth club, and there weren't enough youth for the youth club. So they ended up putting the library.
This is fascinating, though. You know, because I just picture him in like some big version of a wheelbarrow, just being carted into town.
Kind of, yeah.
And it's like bumpy. I mean, he's like, you know, bumping all over the place at the same time. It's not like there's a smooth roadway.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another line that's so lovely. There's a lot of wonderful lines, but I hate to see empty houses, homes from which the soul of a family has taken flight. And it was when you had gone back to see, you know, the home that you were at. And home means so much to so many people. These days, I think it means even more. I think it's one of the reasons that people are fleeing the city and they're trying to make home. Like, what is home going to mean? As you've gone back, have your feelings changed as your perspective has changed when you go back? Or do you go back and immediately feel that warmth of everything, of being there?
Places change, you know, everything changes. And in the town that was closest to where I grew up, you know, the main town was two miles away. You know, it's become a little bit more she, I would say. A few more shops that sell things that people don't need, but they want. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a kid, you know, you went to the fishmonger, there were three or four butchers in town. You know, there were a couple of tea shops. There was, you know, the hardware store, this store, that store, you know, the grocery stores and so on. There were also what we used to call haberdashery stores, mm-hmm. you know, where you could buy everything from a shirt to your, you know, tea towels and things like that. And now there are more shops where, you know, it's stuff.
It's elite. It's an elite stuff. It's things.
Yeah, it's stuff. And so I think there's not that sense of people going about their business and then you stop as you go about what you're doing in your day. You know, this where people didn't have a chance to really wander because they had to get on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. But there was still time to talk and to, you know, it's that, as I said, the web holding community together. I think mm-hmm. it's lovely. And I, you know, I love living in that kind of place. Mm-hmm. I think it's really.
Yeah, even this week we did Halloween with the children and we put the candy up on the streets and everything. Yeah. And it was just like, we came together of how we're going to make this work for the kids. I think they loved it because they didn't have to walk down long driveways. They thought this was like totally perfect because it was like, wait, can we do that again next year? Because, you know, like, we don't want to ring the doorbell. It's much more expedient to just pick up and go. But it was interesting to see how, when things happen, like what's going on right now, what people will do to try to make it work. And I think that when you were going into town, it was like, well, I was pushing the stroller the whole way, but by the same token, I was going to get to see everybody. I was going to get to visit. I was going to have a special moment. Mm-hmm.
You know? And I loved, there were shops that I loved going into, you know, the stationery shop, you know, where it sold all sorts of things, not just stationery, it was magazines, newspapers, toys, but a lot of things that you would, you know, it's where I was allowed to buy my first fountain pen and things like that. And, you know, these wooden floors, and it always felt that there was a certain smell in there. You know, it's always smelt like ink and blotting paper and magazines and newsprint. So it was lovely. It's a different shop now, and so it just smells of candy, I suppose. But you know, it was lovely, and also it was slightly dark. So I don't know, there was lots of lovely memories and lovely experiences that I could reflect upon, and, you know, a certain richness to that as well.
Yeah. You know, you also came to understand class and your station in life as it applies to what meals were called, because it was tea, is this, if you're rich, if you're that. And it was just very interesting to see that whole perspective that, oh, wait, we're eating that way? Is that not the way everyone does it?
Yeah, it's true. And funnily enough, one of my friends who's currently reading my memoir, I sent her a copy, and she thought that was great. She said, gosh, she said, you know, it's so true, you know, because she grew up in Yorkshire, and she was like me, you know, your tea was your evening meal. Supper was that slice of toast and a cup of hot chocolate you had before you went to bed. Well, actually, we didn't call it hot chocolate in those days. It was a cup of cocoa. You know, and, you know, and funny enough, you know, dinner, school dinners, everybody laughs about school dinners. That's what you had at lunchtime. Mm-hmm. And when we were out working on the farm, you know, lunch was something you had round about 10 o'clock in the morning. That's what we called it. That was our lunch. It wasn't coffee break or something. You might have a cup of coffee, but it wasn't called coffee break.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then you had your dinner, and then we had our tea at 6 o'clock. And that, it's always interesting to me, although there is, In Britain, depending again on your station in life, you know, tea, as in afternoon tea, if you're doing a posh afternoon tea, that's sort of something you have around about 3 or 4 o'clock. Whereas if you have high tea, that is something more substantial that you would have around about 5 or 6 o'clock. And then you might have, depending on your station in life, supper a bit later on, which was a meal. We didn't do that in my house. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing is that when I coming to America and hearing people talk about high tea, and what they're having is a cup of tea and a few scones. That to me is just a cup of tea and a few scones. That is not high tea. High tea would have a savory in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting. And also, yes, different quote unquote, you know, classes of people would have different a different vocabulary for the meals they eat.
Yeah, and you're sitting there like, wait a second, I'm a kid. Like, wait a second, what are you eating? What is this? Yeah. Oh, I'm learning here. I'm learning. Yeah. You know, life was challenging in many ways. I mean, let's get serious about it. It was very, very challenging when you were growing
up.
Sure
was.
But it was at the time, it was your life. And now you're seeing it. How do you think that shaped who you are for what you went through? Because there's so much on the page that I've known you for years that I did not know that this was, you know, growing up and, you know, the way you lived. And how do you think it shaped to the person you are?
I think something that I definitely got from my mother's generation and my mother and father's generation, and this will be true of my cousins and true of so many people I know, is that it gives you a sense of endurance and resilience. You know, it's do not whine about stuff. Just get on with it. You know, there was that just get on with it. It's not just keep calm and carry on. It was get on with it. You know, what are we all going to do? Are we all going to sit and whine, or are we going to do something? Mm-hmm. You know, I remember even as a child, if something went wrong, I was allowed a certain amount of time to cry. And then it was, you know, that's enough. It's are you done yet? And if you're done, get on with it. In fact, here's a little story I didn't tell. When I was a very little girl, I had this little chair that was given to me. And one day when something had happened, if I was going to cry about anything, it was about animals that died. So that was probably it. And I went, and my mum said, well, go to your crying chair. And after that, she called it my crying chair. And I only went to, and if I was sad, I'd go to my crying chair, and she would come along and say, have you finished yet? I said, well, no, I've got a bit more to go. And so, but once you were out, I was out, and this is, I'm talking about 3 years old, that sort of age. Once I was done, I had to be done with it. There was no going back and grizzling about it again. In fact, that was one of my mum's terms, to stop grizzling about things, just get on with it. And so I think here's what that's done. That's given me, I think, a sense of resilience, endurance. It's sort of, you know, that you can get things done, that you can go through whatever this is you have to go through. And also a work ethic, definitely a work ethic, which is not always to one's advantage. I mean, one of my cousins has tried to retire 4 times. I think he's making another stab at it. Mm-hmm. Another one of my cousins who left school, I think he was 15 when he left school, now about 67. And last year at my aunt's 90th birthday party, I found out he's just completed a degree in applied mathematics. Mm-hmm. He's probably the only one in, I mean, applied mathematics. I mean, right.
That's something for fun. Just for fun. Let me take
off my hat. I take off my hat to you.
Right.
But I don't, I wouldn't want you to think that's just me and my family. This, it's a real generational thing. Mm-hmm. And it's, mm-hmm. it speaks to, again, to time and place. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, when you've been through a war, you know, it's like, what else is going to hurt me?
You know? Well, you know, and that leads me to, there were surplus women in the old ladies' home. It wasn't the old people's home. It was the old ladies' home. And we touch on the effects of war on family in many ways that we don't really think about. And there was such a toll beyond those who died. There were all these women that would never marry. There were all these people that would never have children. There were always people that would have a very different life. It would always be maiden. They would always, and even the woman that you found something from when her husband, I'm not going to give anything away, her boyfriend had passed away. And she gave you a memento. And it was these things that these people carried as memories, but they went on with their lives. But there were whole generations of people or whole groups of people that were very much impacted by this, just as being the surplus women. And I just said, you know, there are things that we think about with the war, but then it's like, well, who were those people that just never got the opportunity that others did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was, you know, the First World War. And I think one of the things that I look back on at the time, I used to think, oh God, you know, I'm living in this place with all these old people. And although I really loved listening to stories when they came my way, but that's one thing that I think has been a gift, is that being able to observe and see people that had lived through a different era, and to be close to those people. And of course, you know, I knew kids and so on, but having that proximity to people that would often say in my day, you know, and also that where I lived, it had so many connections to a different age, which was very, I mean, there are certain things, for example, the hunt, fox hunting, which is actually hunting a fox in the way that it's been done for years, is now illegal in Britain, but the hunt still meets to go off and they chase, you know, a scent instead. But when I was a kid, it was the hunt in a very traditional sense. They met at the local pub, as they would do now, for their stirrup cup before going off. But then when I was a kid, there were ladies who still rode side saddle with the typical habit, the little bowler hat. And that's just an example of how that, I sometimes felt I was in this bubble, that I was this kid, you know, that was born in the middle of the 21st century, 20th century, sorry, and middle of the 20th century, and yet the place had its roots in Edwardian times, you know. And I think that gave me a lot. They gave me a lot. It definitely gave me a lot of material in later years.
You know, and I was thinking about this. There are details about the war, like the medical blue uniforms, which I had not thought about, and the white feather movement. And you write about war and its effects in the Maisie Dobbs series. Did writing this book bring you more ideas? Now, granted, it's a different time there, but did it give you more ideas about, like, how people behaved and what they've done?
Writing the memoir hasn't given me more ideas. It just probably expresses the ideas I already had, you know, because I... just from knowing my grandparents, my parents, my family, the people I grew up around, it gives you a sense of the way people thought about things, the way they expressed themselves or didn't, the language they used. So it all is in the mix, you know, and some people might have to research that sort of thing, and I don't have to research it because it's all there automatically. Mm-hmm. In little ways, for example, this is an example I think I've used before when I've spoken. It's just a small thing, but my grandmother would never have said, "Well, I won't do that." She would have said, "I shan't," and so I'll. But she wouldn't have say. I wouldn't say, "Well, I'll do that in a minute." She would say, "I'll do that presently." Mm-hmm. You know, little little sort of it's aspects of locution which are which suggest time and place, mm-hmm. and you know, certain sayings. Well, be that as it may, you know, you know. And one of my favorites was, you know, I don't want to over-egg the pudding. You know, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to over-egg the pudding, but this is what I think about that, you know, or something. So all the things that it's a bit like, you know, she's got snappy little hocks, ain't she? I've collected those things. I collected those things as a child. I kept mm-hmm. them in my head, though. I didn't always write them down, but I kept them.
It was like, okay, yes, I have this little moment. I have this little thing. I'm going to just trap that up. Yeah. You know, as rich as your writing is, and the book is so fantastic, there's this wonderful epilogue with even more. And there's these little nuggets about your family. And I'm going to urge readers, when you read this book, don't miss the epilogue, because there's so many great pieces in there. And it's almost like, and now, wait, I forgot that one. But let me just get that in there, though, too, because it was really important. And I just love that, you know, the way that all worked. But let's talk about the title for a moment, because I think this is going to sell this book more than anything else. And every time I told people, I posted up on social media that I was reading this book, and they go, I hope it's true. They said, is she clairvoyant? What does she know? You know, was the title always this year, this time next year, we'll be laughing? Was that always it?
Always, always, always. And I've got to tell you, for years. So it is not with a reflection of our current political situation or whatever. It was something my dad used to say. Yeah. And whenever we went through a difficult time, and people that read the memoir will know there's quite a few of those difficult times, he just had this real, I guess, positive outlook. And I could just see him saying this now. He'd look at you across the table and give you a wink, and then he'd say, oh, never mind, love, this time next year we'll be laughing. And it was as if the minute he said that, you know, light shone through the window, the table would be full of plenty, etc. But more than that, and this is something I said in the book, that what he did was he threw our line out into the future. He cast that line ahead, and it was as if a grappling hook went boom right onto the rock of tomorrow, and you could pull yourself in on that. You mm-hmm. could pull yourself in the promise that today is not going to be every day. Mm-hmm. This too shall pass. Mm-hmm. We can get to that other place where we will all be laughing. Mm-hmm. And I used to imagine, when he said that, I used to imagine sitting around the dinner table, just, oh, we're just holding our sides, killing ourselves laughing, you know, didn't know, you know, not knowing what way to turn because our ribs are hurting so much. That's when I was a kid, I really imagined that. I used to think, well, it's all going to get better now.
Yeah, it's all going to get better. I mean, I felt this should be the anthem for 2020. The next year, this time, we'll be laughing. But, you know, there are going to be moments out of this that are so special. It's people who, their children came home that they hadn't seen in a really long time, and everybody lived together. I have a friend who's got four boys. Her son was living in Ethiopia. He came home, and his wife was pregnant, and the baby was born. Well, this is something that she might not have been able to experience and share. So there are these moments of light that have come out of the whole thing, as well as the darkness. And you're going to take these moments. Things could be worse. Things could be better. Let's just go that it's going to be better later on. And I can see people picking it up, just hoping that you're clairvoyant, you know, just, oh, let her be clairvoyant.
I just imagine my dad up there chuckling away, thinking, oh, well. As my mum once said, it was when she was reading my standalone novel, The Care and Management of Lies. She put it down and looked at me about sort of a couple of chapters in and said, you know what? You cannot say a thing around you because you remember it. She said, it always ends up in a book. And it was some event that I gave in the life of the main character in that book. Her name was Kezia. And it was something that my mother had done as a young married woman. And she just said, you can't say anything around you. It ends up in a book. And I'm sure that's what they're saying up there is, oh, you know, look at her. She just couldn't leave it alone.
She couldn't leave it out there.
It's too good. It's too good.
Now, how old are you in the photo on the cover here? How old are you?
Three. And right. Should I tell you why I was looking so miserable?
Tell me why, because I want to know.
I had just been stung on the lip by a bee. And as you can see, I'm actually working. I'm hop picking.
Yes, yes.
Those are hops. I'm picking into what children would do. the adults pick into large bins that are made of sackcloth and wood, very large. And children, what you'd do with kids is you'd give them a laundry basket, or I had a wicker basket, and they pick into that, and it takes ages for kids to pick hops, but then they tip it into the main bin, so you're working. And so I was 3 years old, and a bead crawled out. I can see it as I speak now. I was holding the hops, this big bumblebee crawled out and then landed right here and stung me. And I think someone got the stinger out pretty quickly. So that obviously someone thought it was really funny to take a photograph of me, because I was probably shed a tear or two, but then I'd have to be quiet because, you know, it's only a bee sting. It's, you know, it's not a matter of life and death unless I was allergic to bees. But the funny thing is, my husband saw a blown up photograph of that, blown up version of the photograph, and he said, "Do you realize you've got a lot of bruises on your arms?" I said, "Well, yeah, it was hard work. You're a kid, you get bruised because you're lifting things." And but I wasn't the only kid working, for goodness sake.
But you didn't even think about that. Yeah. No. Well, I also love the part where you didn't also always want shellfish, and they always wanted you to eat shellfish, and then later on you realized you were allergic. And it was like, definitely allergic. No wonder I didn't eat it all those years. You know, there was a reason.
I know. It was, I really was deathly allergic to it. And we all soon found out. I think I was 11 when my mom said, "Oh, please try it. Please try it." And I, you know, just a little bit, you know, I was so ill. Never again, ever.
My son's allergic to tree nuts, and he had a cookie, a little tiny piece, when he was 3 years old. And he turns around, looks at me, and goes, "My mouth's on fire. My lips are blowing up." And I looked, and I was like, "What?" And we had no idea that's what it was. I thought it was, you know, something completely different. And it's scary, though, because you don't even know where that is in other foods and where it touches. So it goes on like that. Well, you also narrate the audiobook of this. And was that always the plan, that you would do it? Because it seems like such a natural for you to do it.
I had to audition. I had to send a tape, because actually most audiobook publishers, they don't necessarily like the author to read, because authors are not professional readers, and it can take a lot longer. So I actually told them that something I did years ago to make extra money when I first came to the States. I did voiceovers. And so I knew what being in a studio was about. I knew how to get the job done. I went down to LA to a studio there. It was just me and the technician. He was the other side of the booth. And we got that knocked out. Well, I shouldn't say got that knocked out in a week. We got it finished quite swiftly.
Right.
In less than a week. Yeah.
And you know, it's funny because even I'll read the intros of these things, and the inflection, like where you have to stop, where you have to breathe so that you continue to do the sentence. It is an art form to be able to do it.
It is. And you have to get into the rhythm of it as well. Mm-hmm. And to be quite honest, you know, I'm glad someone else does my novels. I mean, people will say, "Oh, you should do your novels." I'm thinking, no, it's not that I'm adverse to hard work, but that's the kind of hard work I want to stop in me as soon as I can. Because you're in a confined space, and, you know, because of the fires in California, you know, it was easy to get very congested. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was a case of take the Claritin, take the Advil, because that takes out all the any inflammation. And, you know, you're just popping pills just to so your throat is open and so on.
Interesting.
Yes. And apparently it was happening to a lot of actors and actresses who normally do voiceovers, that they were having the same kinds of problems. So it wasn't just me. It was everyone was getting a bit like snuffly.
You know, when you were reading, and I think this is so hard for an author to do, is was there a moment where you wanted to change a word? Oh, if I could say that here, because you're reading right off the page. You can't do anything different. And I think that as an author who's edited her own work and been edited, did you have any moments like that of like, "Oh, let me turn that phrase a different way"?
I had about half a dozen, and here's what I did. I changed it, and then we made a note of it, and it went immediately to my publisher, and they changed it on the, we're in time to change it.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Because so many times they're like, no, stay with the page. So that was, yeah. I was glad the reverse could work.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
really good.
I mean, I couldn't make all the changes I wanted, but you know, I made, no, I've got word repetition there. We're going to have to change that. You know,
Do you read aloud? Do you read your book aloud at any point? Because after now doing the audio experience and hearing the repetition or whatever, I've heard of a number of authors that are now reading their books aloud. And they're reading because they said, all of a sudden you realize audio is so important. Like the audio experience has begun. I mean, audio used to be like maybe this part business of the business, and now it's been so much bigger. And a lot of people said that they're now reading their books aloud because they can hear something that you're not going to see on the page.
So, I tend to read sections aloud when I'm revising rather than the whole book, because I don't have time to do that usually. You know, and then I find I start reading and then suddenly I'm reading in my head again. You know, but I when I'm revising, I do, or if there's a certain piece that I'm worrying it a bit, you know, I'll read it aloud just to see how it sounds. And it's not just for the words, it's for rhythm. People forget that actually fiction has a rhythm.
There's a cadence to it. Yeah,
exactly. There's a cadence to it. And so I think it's incredibly useful to read your work. And one of the things that I find useful, you know, when I'm doing a recording, as I have done, I did one recording for one of my books, and it was the abridged version of Pardonable Lies, is using your hands. That really helps if you use your hands, you know. But that comes naturally to me. I used to have a teacher who said, are you sure you're not Italian, you know?
That's my reason. That's what I do.
I've got everything else. A bit of Italian won't hurt.
It helped me that too. So what are you working on now? A new Maisie Dobbs book?
The new Maisie Dobbs book is in production, and that's coming out in March. It's called The Consequences of Fear.
So there'll be two books in a year. Not a bad COVID life.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I'm always working on something. I've been doing some just recently original pieces that you know, to support the memoir and things like that. But I've got some other projects on the go.
Well, we look forward to seeing them. Absolutely look forward to seeing them. This was such a delight, such a treat. People, I really highly recommend reading this book. And it's you know, for fans of your work, yes. But even if you've never read anything else that Jacqueline Winspear has done, you're going to want to experience this, because it's a real snapshot and long movie of what was going on in a time and place. And I think that in a gifted storyteller's hands, it really, really does make a difference. So
well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I thank you for joining us today.
It's been such a
pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great fun. Thank you.
And to our readers, we look forward to seeing you next time for another Book Reporter Talks To. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from This Time Next Year We'll Be Laughing, narrated by the author, Jacqueline Winspear, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Recorded Books.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are three ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network. Thank you to our producer of today's episode, Austin Rue.
Thanks to our research assistant, Emily Dankies. And now, hear an audio excerpt from This Time Next Year We'll Be Laughing, narrated by Jacqueline Winspear, courtesy of Recorded Books.
Prologue. It was our third visit to A&E, the accident and emergency department of the local hospital. The aggressive blood disorder that had been claiming my father's life day by day was bringing us to our knees. Months of regular transfusions were now wreaking havoc on every bone in his body. My mother was snappy, her temper breaking down faster than his veins, and I was doing all I could to care for them both, desperate to keep the ship on an even keel, even as it was crashing against the rocks. My brother, John, was still trying to come to terms with what was happening, Only a few months earlier, Dad had hiked for hours with John in the mountains near his home in Ojai, California. And my strong, sturdy father had kept up a young man's pace, not even broken a sweat. His doctor had always said, "Mr. Winspear, you're one of the fittest men I see here in my practice, and I don't mean for your age." We had all felt quite smug. Those Winspear genes were pretty darn good, weren't they? Annette, the senior hematology nurse who'd been our point person from day one, had called the house earlier that morning. "How are you all holding up?" she asked. "Not so great," I replied, feeling as if I were letting the side down. We didn't admit defeat in our family. I explained that Dad was being stoic. Mum was by turns sarcastic and argumentative, then compassionate and caring. "And you?" she asked. I shrugged, as if she were there with me. "I'm all right, Annette, but..." "No, you're not, Jackie. I can hear it in your voice. You're exhausted. It's time you all had a break. Let's get your dad in for a transfusion and some pain meds, and I'll arrange for his transfer to the hospice for respite care. Give you all a chance to draw a breath. But you must tell him we're not packing him off to hospice to die. Just for respite. The ambulance will be with you in about 20 minutes, and I'll be down there in A&E to meet you when you arrive." I told my mother to get ready to leave, then went to my parents' room and knelt alongside my father's bed. "Dad, it's just for respite care, a bit of a break. You'll get a transfusion at the hospital, that'll perk you up, and they'll give you something stronger for that pain in your back. I'll be with you all the time, Dad. Mum's just getting dressed." I helped my dad get up from the bed and steadied him as he made his way to the bathroom. I put out a fresh, iron shirt, his best trousers, and one of his favourite jackets. His leather shoes were polished. Dad was a dapper man, and unless he was working in the garden, he always wanted to be well turned out. Even at 17, when he was first conscripted into the army, he took the uniform to a local tailor for alteration because he didn't like the cut. And now, though he could barely stand, he insisted upon dressing himself. No, he didn't want help from anyone, and certainly no one else could pull off that all-important Windsor knot in his tie. At the hospital, my father was wheeled into a cubicle, where Annette took his hand and explained to us that they were just getting a quarantine room ready for him because A&E is full of people coming in with all sorts of germs, and we don't want your dad catching anything. Then she said she'd like a moment alone with my father. I watched from a distance as Annette sat next to my dad, their heads almost touching while she spoke to him. I've wondered if this was the moment she told him, "Albert, it's almost time." I imagine it might have been. In the quarantine room, my mother and I sat on either side of Dad's bed. I watched as blood and platelets drip, drip, dripped into my father's arm. His shirt sleeves rolled up, his tie removed. He lay on top of the bed linens, and I remember thinking, he's such a smart, dear, lovely man. The plan was that as soon as the transfusion was complete, there would be a short wait and a cup of tea and a pastry for Dad before another ambulance would come to take him to the hospice. In the meantime, we waited, drip, 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 blood and platelets entering my father's body, giving us all a little more time. We spoke of this and that for a while, ordinary things, subjects of no great import. Then Dad turned and reached towards my mother, taking her hands in his own. "Haven't we had a great life?" he said. She leaned her head towards his, pulled back one hand and rested it against his cheek. He moved his head and kissed her palm. As quietly as I could, I stood up and crept away from my chair, my footfall silent as I left the room, turning the door handle without a sound so as not to interrupt their moment. Instead, I stood in the hallway reading and rereading the wall-mounted instructions for evacuation in case of fire. Haven't we had a great life? And in that moment, as I turned and focused on the red backlit exit sign, I felt my chest ache and my breath become short, and I wondered if I shouldn't be admitted into care without delay. My heart had swollen, and I felt a weight on my chest that took my breath away. I love them not only because they were my parents. I love them for who they were, for their resilience and capacity for endurance at the very worst of times. I cherish them for their love of each other, for their love of life and of us. I would have moved mountains to keep them safe together. Haven't we had a great life? Chapter 1. About Me and Memories. Memories appear in flashes of light, in short scenes, in reflections that can make us laugh or bring us to tears. They might come in on a sneaker wave of grief or be buoyed up from our past by a certain fragrance in the air or a sound from afar. The essence of memoir, I suppose, is that it could better be described as rememory. We don't just look back at an event in our past, we're remembering the memory of what happened. It's a bit like putting the laundry through two wash cycles. The whine of a chainsaw in the distance brings back autumn days working on a farm close to our home in England's Weald of Kent. Mist hangs across the land like a silk scarf, not quite touching the earth, but not rising high enough to join a cloud. Sunshine filters through, grainy, as the shades of gold change with the waning day. And there it is, the whine of that chainsaw. I remember, once, walking with my father across the fields close to their new home. Dad hadn't quite settled. It would take him a long time to feel anything akin to the love he had for that old house at the end of a Victorian terrace where he and my mother had lived for over 24 years and raised two kids. As we walked that day, we found a hop vine growing through the hedge, a leftover from the days when the field had been a hop garden. The hop vine is always called a bine in Kent and Sussex, and hops are grown in a garden, not a field. My father pulled a couple of hops from the vine and crushed them between his hands, and then brought his nose to his palms, his eyes closed. My whole childhood is rushing before me, he said. Some 30 years later, I watched as my brother threaded dried hops through the 100 red roses atop my father's coffin. Our memories of childhood, too, were woven with the spicy fragrance of the hop gardens of Kent. But the story really begins many years before, in London, and not the posh part. We are, all of us, products of our family mythology. Stories are not only passed down, but nestled in every cell. When I thought about writing a memoir, I knew I had to write my parents' story because I am of them. Everything that happened in my childhood, every household decision, every peal of laughter, and every sharp word snapped across the table was underpinned by my parents' attitudes to the world around them. Those attitudes were forged not only in their youthful experience of wartime London, but by a few post-war years, the years when they were uprooted from family and became, in the parlance of their time, gypsies. But before I press the play button on that story, here's something about me and memories. My first memory is of something that happened when I was 6 months old, or thereabouts. I distinctly remember the scene, though it lasted perhaps only a couple of minutes. No one told me about it because no one else was there, so this was not a matter of absorbing other people's memories. The bird was there, and I now believe he was a sparrow. It's a fair bet. There are a lot of sparrows about. My memory is of being in my pram. At the outer periphery of my vision, I can see the edge of the hood to the left, right, and above. In front of me is the handle, way out in front of me. The covers must have been close to my chin, because at the lower edge of my vision there is a white blurring, as if a blanket had been pulled up against whatever the weather was doing. Weather is always doing something in England, and in the mid-1950s, whatever it was doing did not deter mothers from putting their babies outside, even as far away as the bottom of the garden. It was deemed good for us. It was probably also very good for mothers who needed a bit of peace and quiet. My attention had been drawn to a bird as it landed on the handle. I know I focused on it before I reached out to try and touch the bird. I remember feeling frustration because I could not control the hand, so the fingers kept going in and out of focus as I opened and closed them, trying to reach the sparrow. I failed because my hand came down and hit me on the forehead, my babyish lack of motor control. I had no words to think, nothing intellectual to trouble my new brain. But I remember the physicality of frustration at not being able to reach that bird. Then the sides of the hood seemed to close in, and the outside world was pushed back. After I wrote that paragraph, I went through some old photographs until I found one of me at that age, snuggled up in my pram. And there it is, that big fluffy white blanket tucked almost to my chin. I have a long memory. I've thought about it a lot, and I believe it has something to do with the accident. It was as if the shock did something to me that left me with more than physical scars, and after I recovered, it seemed that events I might have forgotten were locked into my memory bank. On the other hand, I find it funny that I can remember details from very early childhood onward, yet for the life of me, I can never find my keys once I've put them down, or recall whether I remembered to give the dog her thyroid pill. Strange that I should have adopted a dog with a dodgy thyroid, a family affliction that defined much of my childhood. What I remember of the accident, which happened when I was about 15 months old, is this. I was surrounded by grown-ups who were standing beside me around the kitchen table. I felt as high as their knees. We had company. My Auntie Sylvie, Uncle John, and cousins Johnny, Larry, and Martine, who was younger than me by 6 months, so she was probably crawling but not toddling. I was wearing my new nylon dress. It might have been bought in London by my aunt, as nylon dresses for little girls were all the rage because they could be washed and dried quickly. I doubt I cared about the dress, but I loved tea. And I remember I couldn't wait to be given a cup of lukewarm, milky, sweet tea in my red mug. So I reached up to the table to grab the closest handle, which happened to be attached to my father's enamel one-pint army mug. He had held on to it after his army demob years before because he liked his tea scalding hot, and the metal kept it that way. I can still see that handle above me and my hand stretching toward it, my fingers opening and closing as I reached up, just as I'd reached toward the sparrow. That's the last I remember of the accident. My mother told me the tea was so scalding hot, my nylon dress melted into my skin. My father tried to rip it off, then wrapped me in a blanket, and they ran from the cottage to the farm because the farmer had a car. We were living far off the beaten track, in a cottage in the midst of the Bedgebury Forest in Goudhurst, Kent. We had no phone, no car, and no means of getting to the hospital. The farmer's car had to struggle through mud with my father and uncle pushing, I was told, and by the time they reached the main road, I was in convulsions, screaming and screaming and screaming. I still have some scarring across my chest where the dress was pulled away, taking a goodly layer or two of flesh with it, and another on my ribs from a skin graft of some sort. I was shot up with penicillin, which my mother always said saved my life. When I left the hospital weeks later, I started to remember almost everything that came to pass from then on, and a few things from before the accident. Hardly an event happened that was not catalogued in my mind unless I made an effort to forget it. At times, I worked hard at forgetting. This is my memoir of a time and place in a series of vignettes, screenshots, portraits and panoramas. At first, I wanted to call it, "It's All Changed Around Here," and here's why it came to mind. Imagine this. We're on our way from our home in Kent up to London. We comprises my parents, sitting in the front of the Morris Traveller, plus my brother and me on the back seat, likely arguing, perhaps even with fists flying. You might ask why my brother has built a wall of toilet paper rolls between us, and it would be fair to say no one could blame him. I suffered from severe motion sickness, and he just could not stand me throwing up all over him yet again. The car is grey with wood trim. It's our first family car, bought second-hand, and not only does it backfire with some regularity, but the vapour of exhaust fumes coming in through the back doors makes me feel even worse. My discomfort is compounded by the fact that my father is a terrible driver, so the car lurches sideways and forward every time he overtakes another car, usually yelling that the dozy bugger should get off the effing road. Dad had let his license lapse, and he had had to take a driving test again, or maybe that was it. He'd never had a license in the first place. And now, not so long after he had finally passed the test on his sixth attempt, we were en route to visit our London relatives in what was supposed to be the comfort of our own car. Fields and farms gave way to concrete and suburbia, then to an inner city still bearing livid scars of wartime bomb sites and blitzed broken houses, this in the mid-1960s. As the names of streets became recognisable to my parents, they would say to each other, "Look at that. Do you remember when?" And a story was told about people we didn't know and a place we didn't understand. Finally, as we reached our destination, probably Auntie Sylvie and Uncle John's house in Camberwell, Dad would shake his head and say, "It's all changed around here." And Mum would agree, and they would look about them and seem bewildered, as if a thief had crept in while they weren't looking and stolen part of their life, something precious never to be seen again. My brother and I teased them relentlessly. We mimicked them, and as we passed this or that street, we'd call out names of places we didn't know, really. And I remember seeing my father and mother grin at each other and roll their eyes. How could we ever understand, we who had not lived in their world, a world they'd left because they could not stay? Change is woven into the fabric of my stories, probably because when I was a child, the dueling senses of belonging and being out of place were ever present, along with a fear that the rug could be pulled out from under us at any moment. But I loved the place where I grew up, despite the fact that, like a lot of kids, I couldn't wait to leave home, to travel, to see the world. Last year, I returned to Cranbrook, which you could say is my hometown, and isn't that such an American locution? I parked on the high street and walked past the Indian restaurant where Palmer and White's, the haberdashery shop, used to be. I made my way past the vestry hall, where the ambulance station was located when I was a child, then up the churchyard steps and along toward the old primary school. I remember once waiting with my mother to watch a bride walking from a ribbon-bedecked car toward the church, her arm linked through her father's, her dress cascading silk atop a flounce of organza petticoats. As I reached out to finger the silk, she turned to me as if she had felt my touch, and she smiled. It was as if an angel had acknowledged my presence and that I, too, could one day look so beautiful. I tried not to let my hand rest upon anything else for the rest of the day. My flesh felt sacred. At the top of the churchyard, I stopped by the old oak tree, the one where our class of five-year-olds, infants one, would sit and listen to Mrs. Willis tell us a story on a fine summer's afternoon. I remember the class walking in pairs from the classroom down to the churchyard. Mrs. Willis would bring a chair, and once she was settled, the whole class of five-year-olds sat cross-legged on the grass looking up at her, waiting for the story to begin. I remember the shafts of light coming down through the trees and feeling so gentled by summer's warmth and the rhythm of her voice. The old Victorian primary school has now been converted to accommodation for seniors, but the oak tree is still there and will be there for a long time, I hope. I walked away from my past just in time to see a bride making her way along the flagstone path toward the church, her hand resting on her father's arm, her bridesmaids following, grinning, fussing with hair and tottering on high heels. I wanted to reach out and touch the silky fabric of her dress, but instead just smiled and said, You look really lovely. And she smiled back. It made my day. Time is a place, and every place has a time for each one of us. Almost 30 years ago, when I first came to live in California, I exercised horses for owners too busy to ride. One of those horses was kept at a private stable in the Marin Headlands overlooking the San Francisco Bay. So after riding, and still clad in my breeches and tall leather boots, I would come down into Sausalito to buy a coffee at a little bakery close to the marina. The owner was originally from Iran. He told me he had been a refugee from Persia. As he was making my latte, he asked what kind of horse I rode, and I told him she was a gorgeous Arabian. His eyes lit up. His smile broadened. I think it was what he had hoped to hear. My father bred the Turkoman Arab, he told me, holding his hand against his heart. And thereafter, several times each week as I sipped my coffee at the counter, he would tell me another story of the Arab horses he had grown up with. Though he declined my offer to come to the stables, he said it would be too painful a memory. I've thought about the Iranian man a lot over the years, and of the many people on the move across the globe. I've thought of the things that open the gates to that sneaker wave of nostalgia, reminding immigrants, and I am one, of the place of their first belonging, their first love, I suppose. It could be the fragrance of a flower only grown in their country, or a familiar turn of phrase overheard. Perhaps it's the way the dusk settles across the ocean, or even the image of a horse holding its tail high, nostrils flared as it gallops across the headlands near the San Francisco Bay. And here, in California, in my house close to redwood groves and golden hills, I have a small Hessian bag of hops, a tiny replica of the pokes our Kentish hops were packed into, sacks taller than a man to be taken to the breweries. Using a blanket stitch of thick string to secure the dried hops inside, my father made that small poke at the end of my first hop-picking season, when I was just 6 months old. He printed our last name in white chalk along the flank and added the year, as if claiming that season for me forever. I've a photograph of me that very September. I'm in my mother's arms as she's laying me down to sleep on a coat atop a mound of spent hop binds. The two dogs, working farm dogs Bess and her daughter Lassie, lay beside me, never to leave me, for they were my guardians. No one could entice them to move, and no one dare approach me. Only my father or mother could touch me. When I first read Of Human Bondage by W. Somerset Maugham, I smiled when I came across a description of hop gardens in Kent and mothers laying their young down to sleep on mounds of spent hop binds covered by a coat or a blanket. I remember thinking, that was me. And it made me feel special. I felt as if that famous writer had walked by and caught a glimpse of me while I was a baby sleeping. The writer Adam Nicholson, who comes from the same area in Kent, writes about the gift of place in his book Sissinghurst, An Unfinished History. Nicholson refers to place as the roomiest of containers for human meaning. The land where I grew tall is filled with meaning for me. It's the land of hop gardens and apple orchards, of farms and fields, of trees to climb and streams flanked by pungent wild garlic and golden sun-reflecting celandines. This deep love of place is part of my family mythology, a delicate web across my heart. I love thinking about place, wondering how places change or don't, and I like looking at what place does to people and people to place. I'm fascinated by what it means to be held in place and how place gives our lives meaning and how we assign meaning to a place. I live some 6,000 miles away from the land of my growing, and even from such a distance, I can feel my roots in that soil. Take me there blindfolded, and I would know I had come home. The air's texture and fragrance, the sounds, the sense of light, even though my eyes are closed, I would know I was where I belonged once. And perhaps it's truly where I belong now, Writing memoir is a way of discovering something about ourselves, so perhaps there's something to be revealed to me. But time has marched on, and so have I. And if truth be told, even as a child, I always felt as if I were on the outside looking in, so it's comfortable for me to live in a country where I'm not expected to be like anyone else, because I come from a different place. Perhaps the early years when my parents were considered outsiders has something to do with it.